This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Donna Drucker, assistant director of scholarship and research development at the Columbia University School of Nursing. We're discussing her latest book from the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series, Fertility Technology. Fertility Technology begins by examining the first instance of artificial insemination performed over 150 years ago and takes us to the present, showcasing our wide range of fertility technologies today. The politics of pregnancy is one of the most contentious in current discourse. Understanding the technologies used in many pregnancies is of utter necessity, and Donna shows why in this concise and highly readable volume. Donna, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, you know, as I said, you know, this is one of those topics where I feel like if people knew more about the technologies involved and more about the background, we could have a saner public debate. So, hopefully, after this, people will have a little bit more knowledge and be able to contribute to discourse a little bit better. But before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, sure. I received a PhD in history from Indiana University in 2008. And I wrote it on Alfred Kinsey and his intellectual history. So ever since then, I've been interested in the intersection of science and technology with gender and sexuality. And so that interest has manifested in now 4 books and a number of other academic publications and podcasts. And it's a intersection in human history that continues to fascinate me.
And as far as this particular book is concerned, I know that this is part of the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series. So how did you get involved in this project?
I wrote a different book for MIT Press's Essential Knowledge series that came out in April of 2020, just as the lockdowns were happening throughout the world. And as I realized, I was living in Germany at the time, I wasn't going anywhere. I thought, why don't I write another book? Because that will keep me engaged alongside my regular work activities. And so Renee Almeling, who's a sociologist at Yale University, held a kind of symposium on her new book, Gynecology, new book at the time. And she organized groups of senior and junior scholars who were all working on some aspect of infertility or fertility technology. And so I met these fascinating scholars who are doing excellent work. And I thought, well, I've written a book on contraception now. Why don't I write a book on the opposite, which is fertility technology? And so this book is essentially a pandemic project that came out of my work on contraception.
So you begin the book with a history of the first ever artificial insemination. So I was wondering if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about this moment and how it first happened.
Sure. Listeners may have heard of a physician named J. Marion Sims. And he is, I guess, notorious for having conducted gynecological experiments on enslaved African-American women. And he did that for a period of time. And then he moved to New York City in the 1850s and started working at a women's hospital. And it was there that he began to experiment with artificial insemination. And so what he did was stand by, basically, while a married couple had intercourse. He would syringe the semen out of the woman's vagina and then reinsert it further beyond the cervix in the hope that placing the semen in the vagina further up in the cervix to get it as close to the uterus as possible in the hope that the semen would be more likely to stay in place and the sperm would be more likely to implant an egg. This only happened successfully once, and the woman lost the pregnancy several months in. But this type of experiment may have happened before, but this was the first time someone had written about it. And so Sims became well-known in American and European gynecological circles. His work was republished several times in different languages. And he became known for mostly for worse, but also for better, at least in terms of his instruments, the father of American gynecology. But this type of experiment with maneuvering semen rather quickly became a regular part of a lot of gynecology practice, not necessarily publicized, but became more or less available in Western European countries in the US.
Why is it that some people seek a technological fix for infertility? What are, obviously there's, it's very personal, can be very personal reasons, but you know, are there some broad reasons that people seek to do it as opposed to, you know, other avenues like adoption or things like that?
People seek fertility treatments for a number of different reasons. In the past, it's most often been heterosexual married couples who have undiagnosed and unexplained fertility problems. They can't conceive in just through regular heterosexual intercourse, and so they seek treatment. And most of the treatments that are the technologies that I'm discussing in this book are not necessarily fertility treatments in that they don't cure infertility, but they help people become pregnant. So there's a distinction there. But also people who are in same-sex relationships, single people, people who have some kind of pelvic, gynecological, urological diseases, they undertake these treatments as well. So it's as time moves forward, there more and more people are seeking these kinds of treatments and more people are legally allowed in their countries to seek them. Because, for example, in a place like Denmark, fertility treatment was forbidden to lesbian women or single women until a certain amount of activism took place and encouraged the government to remove that restriction. So in general, it's started out as a heterosexual, as a mechanism for heterosexual couples, but it's broadly expanded to a lot of other folks.
So in addition to some of the work and experimentation that Dr. Sims was doing, what are some of the other early fertility technologies that were used prior to in vitro fertilization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the technologies include insufflation and a salpingogram. And these are diagnostic techniques that appeared in the 19-teens and the 1920s and that were used through the 1960s. And insufflation came first. It's a technology in which the air is pushed into a woman's vagina, into her uterus, and the amount of compression that is, or the amount of pressure that is produced or not produced is a measure of whether the fallopian tubes are blocked or not. So if the fallopian tubes are blocked, the air stays in the uterus for a longer amount of time. If they're clear, it dissipates. So it's diagnosing one type of infertility, which is some kind of disease in the fallopian tubes. And that was a Austrian physician who moved to the US who discovered that machine. A different man in the UK discovered a machine or invented a machine that uses liquid and pushes liquid into the uterus, looks at it under an X-ray to see where blockages might be. You can imagine this is not a pleasant experience, but it does do a decent job of showing whether or not the fallopian tubes are clear. But lots of people see fertility as a place where they can experiment. And you could receive, for example, hormone injections. When hormones, identities of different kinds of hormones were discovered in the 1930s, especially progesterone and estrogen, people thought, hey, why not just inject yourself with some hormones and kind of see if that helps. It doesn't help that directly, but plenty of people made some money hawking them. So the other less technologically oriented method that was discovered in the 1920s and is still used in the present is timing. So up until the 1920s in Japan, no one really knew exactly when an egg formed and dispersed into the uterus. There are lots of recommendations, there are lots of ideas, but no proof. And then a Japanese physician named Ogino found that it happened approximately 15 to 17 days before the next cycle. But you didn't know this unless you were reading gynecological journals in Japan until about the 1930s, in 1933-34, when Ogino visited an Austrian physician named Knaus, who was working on the same problem in Austria. They collaborated on some work, got work translated into German, and from there, the knowledge of when ovulation occurs was more or less available to anyone who could read English or German. And then, of course, the Catholic Church adopts this method and has still continued to promote it ever since. So there's a range of diagnostic and planning technologies that people use in the hopes of having a child.
With these kind of early diagnostic tests and technologies in the background, I was wondering if you could talk about in vitro fertilization or IVF, how this was discovered and the mechanism by which it works.
Yes, sure. IVF was experimented on throughout the 1960s by a team in the UK and also a little bit later in the early 1970s by physicians in Australia. Those are the two main areas, or I'm sorry, the two main countries where this took place. There had been some work done in the 1940s in the US, but that just kind of fell to the side. So there are two physicians and a laboratory assistant, Patrick Steeptoe, Robert Edwards, and Jean Purdy, who are active in the UK. And they, with the help of other people, they figure out a way to extract an egg artificially via artificial means, via like a hormone injection. And they extract an egg from a woman's uterus. They get a sperm sample from, in this case, the woman's husband, fertilize the egg with the sperm in a petri dish, thus in vitro, which means in glass, rather than in vivo, which means in life. So They get the egg, they get the sperm, fertilize them in a petri dish, and then reimplant the fertilized egg in the woman's body. And the first birth of a IVF baby was Louise. Her name was Louise Brown, and she's now in her 40s. The birth happened in July of 1978. It was a C-section, and it was a major world event to know that a baby, the first baby that was not conceived in the uterus, was born. It was healthy, and she was perfectly fine. So another Indian physician uses someone's natural cycle and creates an IVF baby a little bit later that year. Australian team does it a couple of years later. And then, so to speak, the IVF races are off. And hundreds of thousands of IVF babies are now out in the world.
So, you know, with this major breakthrough, you know, by the way, 40 years ago, that doesn't seem much, very long ago. Really, this is recent history. Which just shows, you know, how new this all is. But, you know, with these kind of technologies and history in mind, I was wondering if you could talk about some of the major legal and ethical complexities of using fertility technologies.
Yeah, sure. People may have religious objections to fertilization outside the womb, occasionally as a risk of adultery, in case you come across an unscrupulous physician who uses their own sperm instead of the husband's or the partner's and implant and fathers children, usually of his own, without the woman's knowledge or consent. The actual event is fairly rare, but the worry is very present for a lot of people. That worry, and also the ethical considerations of fertilization outside a natural or quote unquote natural process. The second is screening for particular kinds of genetic diseases. So someone may have a genetic disease, or on the mother's side or the father's side, and I will use the gender terms here. And if an embryo is seen to carry the genetic disorder, then the would-be parents will would discard it. And the question is whether that embryo, fertilized embryo, has any rights as a human. And so there are organizations that then take over custody of fertilized embryos and try to give them to people with the parents' consent. But the fate of fertilized embryos that go unused is another issue. Another more rare issue is the idea of producing children through IVF as what are called donor siblings or savior siblings. So, for example, if a child has a blood disorder or a bone disorder, and the only way to find healthy bone or blood or any cells to help cure the original sibling, the only way to do that can be to produce a second or third sibling that has a healthy DNA, healthy bones and blood, who can then donate that, their genetic material, to their sibling. It's fairly rare, but it does happen, and it is an ethical conundrum. Somebody, you're basically existing because your sibling was sick. So there are some definite restrictions around producing siblings in that regard. So those are three examples.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, that last one especially is pretty mind-boggling. And you know, it's you know, every single day it feels like we're inventing a new trolley problem type type moral questions, especially in this realm. This is less about this next question is less about maybe ethical concerns, but just about how fertility technologies are possibly or possibly not changing the nature and meaning of family and kinship ties. You know, obviously there's, you know, like you said, there might be certain religious objections, but how do you see or how have we seen how fertility technologies have made people reconsider what family or kinship means?
Well, that's a good question. So I think it changes how people think of who families are and who they can, how they can come about. One example I discuss in the book is of people who are both female identified who want children, and they have a good friend who's male, and they ask him if he can be a sperm donor. He says yes, and he's not just a donor and then departs their lives. He becomes part of their family, and so he is incorporated as a parent, but not like a full-time parent. And I think what's funny is that the word that they use to describe his relationship to the child is spunkle, so sperm uncle. And so I think that there are lots of ways that, you know, especially people in same-sex relationships or people who have more the same type of genetic material aren't able to produce a child together, but the DNA of a child can be at least half of one partner. And I think we're going to see more and more families that come together with non-heterosexual committed couple combinations.
So taking us up to the present day, what is the current state of fertility research and technology development? And what are some of the future, it's obviously impossible to predict what discoveries will be coming down the pike, but you know, what's the future of fertility technology?
Oh, you're asking a historian about the future. Uh-oh. I'm not as quite.
Yeah, don't make any predictions, but you know, what are the major, I suppose the major projects that are being worked on right now where, you know, obviously, you know, in, you know, with genetic research, for example, you know, about, you know, with CRISPR, it's like, we don't know the future, but we might be able to predict, okay, we might be able to delete certain genes and change people's, you know, change people's predispositions towards certain traits. You know, obviously that this is slightly different, but, you know, just as far as what researchers are working on today, some of the major problems that they're looking at.
Yeah, I think one of the major innovations of the past 10 years or so is time-lapse imaging, in which people can put together a fertilized embryo and then do time-lapse imaging to show how the embryo will develop over a period of a few days, and then decide which of those embryos looks the healthiest or the least likely to contain any genetic diseases, and then decide to implant those embryos or one or more of those embryos. This is developed in the UK in the past 7 or 8 years. It's also in the US. But as you can imagine, it's not only very expensive, but it also takes a very trained eye to see how a disease might be predictable and manifest, you know, much later on in a child's life. But interestingly enough, there have not been any major breakthroughs in technology really since the 1990s. And that breakthrough was called intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI, which is the process of selecting an individual sperm and it fertilizing an egg with it rather than other kinds of IVF or other kinds of techniques where you would just put a bunch of sperm or a drop of semen into a petri dish where the egg was and then let the best sperm win. This is much more targeted. But that happened 30 years ago. That was 1993. And so with the exception of the imaging, what a lot of fertility companies are doing is encouraging people to purchase these different kinds of what are called add-ons. So they might be something like, it's a kind of unpleasant term, but it's called uterine scratching. So they might, they being the company physicians might incise a small scratch on the uterine wall, irritating it in the hopes that that kind of activity would encourage an egg to implant. Other companies might recommend things like that are less invasive, like acupuncture, chiropractic care, things like that. But I think we're not seeing as much innovation on the technical side, more along the business side of fertility technology, especially in the U.S., because the U.S. is basically very underregulated when it comes to fertility technology. So a lot of companies have emerged kind of packaging fertility services, especially for young women. Say, oh, we'll give you the chance to freeze your eggs. You'll get IVF. You'll get fertility storage, or I'm sorry, egg storage, and it'll all come together in a package for you along with these other add-ons. Whether or not that's a good idea for a lot of people is another question, but I think the more of the innovation recently has come in the business side of fertility rather than the technology side.
For those who are interested in this topic and want to know more or want to follow the research, how would you recommend a layperson go about learning about this topic in addition to just this introductory book?
Mm-hmm. I think a country that is more regulated and has more information, I guess, is not unbiased or anything. What I would suggest is looking at the website of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority in the UK. It's called HFEA is the acronym. And what they do is publish a lot of information on these kinds of add-ons that people might be encouraged to use. They evaluate the accuracy of them. They make sure that these add-ons are tested in randomized control trials. And if not, they recommend, you know, people are more cautious about taking on these add-ons. For American listeners, the regulation that the HFEA website offers is not as relevant. I think it's a well-organized, easy-to-read website that keeps track of developments in fertility technology that I think readers will appreciate regardless of where they are.
And, you know, moving on from just this particular book, you know, what else are you working on today?
I've been working on a book that continues my interest in science and technology with gender and sexuality. I've been working on a book on abortion from about the 1860s through the soft present, and that's under contract with Reaction Books. And maybe further down the road, I'll continue my interest with a book on menopause. But that's just an idea right now.
Yeah, you're clearly very, very active writing about so many different topics. Well, Donna, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. You know, we look forward to having you on again in the future when those projects come to fruition.
Great. Thank you for having me. My pleasure.